be ridiculous.
Welcome, friends, to Perfect Stranger Things, a weekly dance of joy for your eardrums. Today, Steve and I cover the back half of the piggy backpack. This will conclude our coverage of season 4. We will be back at some point on this feed to do a rewatch of seasons 2 and 3, so stick around for that. Just a note, Steve and I talk for about 7 minutes about this premiere in LA we've been invited to relative to House of the Dragon. If you want to skip all that, skip ahead about 7 minutes and you'll get right into the Stranger Things stuff. If you are a Game of Thrones / House of the Dragon fan, go ahead and check us out on the Double Dragon feed. Search for that wherever you search for podcasts. All right, here's a few morsels from the man with the magic mustache. That's right, it's Mr. Wilford Brimley.
You got a story in here. This is the damnest story you ever read. Tell you what we're gonna do. We're gonna sit right here and talk about it. Now we'll talk all day if you want it. It's the right thing to do.
What's the plan? Are we gonna have a discussion? Because if we're gonna go see this early, the House of the Dragon. I mean, obviously, we don't want to talk about it before the show comes out because spoilers and everything. But
okay, when's the actual drop date for this? So this comes out August 21st.
Oh, really? So it's like a month.
So here's what I think we should do.
Just spoil it.
All right. I think
they killed Ned again.
Yeah, how should we cover House of the Dragon? I feel like because we're going to this event on July 27th, we should just do a pod that talks about our experience of the event.
Yeah.
That's a good idea. And maybe some, you know, totally non-spoiler reactions to just like our sense of the show. Like, are we excited about the show going forward?
Yeah, I think that's a good idea. And who knows? There may be some sort of weird interactions that we want to talk about too. So
there's always the chance that we will bump into George R.R. Martin and get him drunk. You know, probably get him drunk. You know, maybe plant a few seeds. You know,
exactly. Yeah, I love it.
Tell them how we would like to see.
I don't know if you guys how much you filmed, but I'm thinking.
All right, yeah. So Steve and I, in the interim, in just a couple weeks, Steve, you and I are gonna go to the premiere of House of the Dragon in L.A.
Yeah, I don't know if we should feel super honored or if that's a bad sign for how well they think the show is going to do that they would let you and I go see it early.
They've done a few test audiences. They've realized we're going to need all the help we can get.
Yeah. I mean, it's just going to be just a bunch of gross podcasters trying to figure out what evening chic looks like.
You know, this is the dress code we've been told, evening chic. What does evening chic look like on Steve Osborne?
That's a good question. I mean, because I kind of looked it up and tried to find, like, parallels. And what I could kind of figure out, it was sort of a sexy business casual. My understanding is, you know, slacks or, you know, designer jeans. So I'll probably go jeans, nice jeans.
How many buttons will you have undone? That's my question.
On my jeans? All of them.
You're going to go full Teen Wolf on the zipper of your jeans?
Exactly, yeah. Celebration for Michael J. Fox's free throw. Welcome to the jungle. I mean, depending on, like, I have some clothes that I would consider. They fit pre-pandemic. sure. So
I think people should know that you're a much more conscientious dresser than I am. you know, so after we got this invite, you'd started to do some research on what evening chic might be.
Right.
Whereas my wife did research for me.
Right.
What evening chic might be. And I guess you guys both went to the same website.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. Yeah, I was even crowdsourcing some shoe options. I went through my shoes, and so I got some feedback. So I think I know where I'm. So I like to build from the ground up.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, me barefoot. Nothing says business sexy than going full hobbit.
Little toe cleavage. Yeah, just give them what they want. Yeah, no, I look forward to fumbling our way into the place. Mm-hmm. I look forward to realizing that I don't belong there almost immediately, and then really excited about making a scene at the after party.
Okay, so yeah, the after party is kind of the wild card, right?
Mm-hmm.
Because if this thing is not impressive, right? If people don't like it,
right?
There's gonna be a lot of fake bullshit that happens at this after party.
Oh yeah.
A lot of people pretending that they're really excited for a show that had a pretty bad start.
I'm predicting that we're gonna be headed to the after party, and we will have very clear credentials that say we're podcasters, and we will have a segment of the after party that we can go to, and we may or may not be able to see like the actual like actors, and we will probably be in a what I would imagine was they may have like a McDonald's Playland just for the podcasters to go.
There'll be a sandbox.
Yeah, we'll be entitled to one free Bud Light. And the rest we have to pay for.
So, yeah, I think that what we'll do is we'll just drop a podcast, sort of just talking about what it's like and just give our general feelings about.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know why all the dragons had a talk, but.
All of a sudden the dragons talk now. This is this is fantastic.
And there was the one dragon that would only talk whenever it was with its master, and it would sing, "Hello, my baby. Hello, my darling. Hello, my ragtime gal."
I need my fancy dice here. That bird, man, that bird's really going for it.
I can't even hear the bird.
It's fine. I like it. I like the bird.
Serenity now.
Steve, we're covering the piggyback part 2. Really, this is supposed to be like the last hour and 20 minutes of this episode. And I just rewatched this portion.
Okay.
And you know what I was thinking this time?
Hmm.
I was thinking, you know, with Cocoons of Horror, we just covered Doctor Strange.
Right.
And I was saying how much I really wanted all of the more mind shenanigans and maybe fewer energy blasts.
Right.
I think that this gave me all the mind stuff I was looking for.
Is that right? Okay, cool.
Yeah, I mean, I think that Doctor Strange could have learned a lot from this episode. Because not only do we have the mindscape, but sort of like have like mind, you know, memories within memories. And, going into different rooms and different memories, and then each memory kind of becomes either a hiding place or a battleground.
Yeah, like, because when Elle ends up in a earlier memory for Max, where Max is even younger, but then she encounters, like, a Vecna interruption.
Yeah.
Which suggests he's in the mind as well. But it's not necessarily like it's interesting how there's like these breadcrumbs kind of throughout of that they leave behind, right? I mean, because he's not in that memory; he's in the school dance memory.
Mm-hmm.
But then the school dance, she starts to see visions of that in Max's other memory. So it also just I think it does a pretty good job of dealing with the complexity of the human mind without telling you it's doing that, right?
Right, and then halfway through, what ends up happening, you know, it takes Elle a while to find the right memory, and I like that she doesn't really know what she's doing. She's kind of muddling through these memories. So they go from the skate park, which, by the way, it's not a skate park. It's like the LA River.
Right.
Which is where they, you know, iconic image from T2.
Yeah, exactly.
Coming right off the bridge and, you know, the big semi-truck coming down into that little concreted ravine or whatever.
Was that also where the Grease race was?
Yeah, that's right. That's right. I hadn't thought about that. So they go from there to the snowball, and then they go from the snowball into Vecna's mind. So it's like all of a sudden it's the snowscape to the hellscape.
Right.
And you really have that kind of fire and ice kind of theme, and you almost have, I don't want to make too much of it, but you did have that moment where Vecna raises his arms and all the shards of wood start flying at 11.
Right.
And just that slow raising of the arms kind of reminded me of the Night King.
Right.
That, not to say that it was on purpose, but, you know, you did have the same, you know, special effects guy in both.
Yeah, no, for sure. And it's interesting how some of the critiques, you know, have been, you know, that Stranger Things didn't kill enough people, and you know, the Duffers are like, well, we're not Game of Thrones.
yeah, that's right.
But you're not Game of Thrones.
Well, here's the thing about this: if you think about per capita, if you think about Game of Thrones, it's like you've got, you know, what do you have, like 24 characters, and a bunch of them die, right? But you still have like dozen left over. So I kind of feel like this show does kill. And it is willing to kill. You know, we saw Eddie die, and, you know, I think, you know, when people say you didn't kill enough people, my sense is that people are thinking, yeah, but I wanted my fan theory to be right.
There's that, right? Yeah, I think also if every main character is protected, then it makes it, it does. It can go from season to season of diluting the stakes or the level of tension. Mm-hmm. You know, if you've come to expect that the Scooby-Doo gang is going to survive, then the Scooby-Doo gang is going to survive, and so their peril becomes less perilous.
And I think that maybe if this was the fourth and final season, I think maybe you would have seen something like that.
Yeah, I mean, they tried it, but they kind of did, right, with Hopper, but then they didn't. So then that sort of takes it the other way, right? Like, you leave season three going, wow, they just killed off Hopper. And then they're like, we're not going to do that. And so there is that sense, too, that, like, and that was where I was at, where, like, okay, will they kill Steve Harrington? But I think we even talked about, like, or does something, they assume he's dead and they have to go back to the Upside Down, a time travel. So we have an opportunity to sort of save him. So I think that's the other expectation, right? Like, Max is clearly jacked up. We don't know what her future holds, but they're, you know, if you're the cynical, well, this isn't Game of Thrones, and you'd be like, oh, she'll get better, right? And it's like, well, that's okay too. Mm-hmm. Not everything has to be Game of Thrones. Not everything has to be Breaking Bad. You know, a little Ted Lasso here and again is fine.
Well, and think about the movies upon which this is based, right? We have to remember, you know, we're dealing with movies like The Goonies, you know, we throw in movies like Alien and, you know, other movies like that too. But, you know, primarily this is based on a lot of these 80s adventure shows where the main character, the good guys, kind of win in the end, you know? And that's the story that they've chosen to tell.
And even though this has that Nightmare on Elm Street quality, I mean, Vecna kills three, maims another. Has a history of doing this to his own family. So, I mean, there's certainly carnage and there's certainly death. I mean, how many people die in the earthquake that gets formed by the gates opening, right?
True.
I mean,
that's true.
I mean, it's just because we don't know them doesn't mean they're not dying, right? I mean, if you go into season three, I mean, gosh, everybody just like turns into goo.
Yeah. I mean, we saw, look, this in this season, Chrissy, we saw Chrissy, we saw, oh gosh, who was the nerdy Anthony Michael Hall journalism guy?
Was it Fred or?
Freddie. Yeah. We saw Freddie die. We saw Patrick die. And this, you know, this, we saw Jason die. We saw Eddie die. I mean, so there's a lot. It's just that, yes, it does seem as if our favorite characters are surviving. And I just understand the kind of story that they're trying to tell.
Well, and in some cases too, I mean, the killing off a main character can be a little bit of an emotional cheat, right? I mean, unless you've really got something mm-hmm. that moves the narrative along. I mean, you know, is the show better if Steve Harrington dies to save Nancy? Mm-hmm. That's debatable, yeah. right? I mean, because now what you've done is you've the other side of it is, well, that's one way to get out of the love triangle, you know, corner you painted yourself into, you know, and mm-hmm. So there is opportunities for that could be, you know, if it's not, I mean, like the Max thing right now, I think really does a good job, because I mean, the fact that, you know, we talked about the narrative armor that we assumed was there, and while I believe she'll be okay, I mean, I don't know that her character won't be blind for the rest of her life. You know, we don't know that. You know?
Yeah, I was so just like, wondering that. Yeah, I was
wondering that because that doesn't. I mean, that complicates things for her, obviously, but I mean, it doesn't. You can still move the story along, right? And you can, mm-hmm. you know, so there are opportunities there that are even more interesting and rich if they're alive, but they're forever. Like, that's the whole thing. Like, everybody's different, right? I mean, everybody mm-hmm. after all of this is like, and Will is a perfect example. I mean, that's how we sort of end, is with, you know, Will's never been the same since the first time we saw him. Sure.
Yeah, that's right.
And I think that's key, right? I mean, like, the redemption of Steve Harrington. I mean, that has everything to do with the experience, right? So...
Okay, I'm going to roll this thing. I should mention, I've identified 6 storylines, so we are Gucherless for this final coverage of season 4. Here we go. All right, this is a number 4. This is Max and Eleven versus Vecna. Max's happy memory place is breached as blood balloons pop, and the atmosphere gets ominous. Vecna shows up and levitates Max, then Eleven shows up and levitates Vecna. Then the mind battle begins. Vecna gets the upper hand and brings the girls to his reddish hellscape. Eleven buys some time by talking about Papa. Vecna monologues about how he found the mind flayer.
How he flayed the mind finder.
How he found the mind flayer and used it as a tool to become the ultimate predator, and how Hawkins will burn and fall to pieces. He wants Eleven to watch him kill Max. Then Mike inspires Elle with his love, and she finds the strength to fight. Then she mind ties him to a pretend post. Vecna turns to smoke. Meanwhile, Max's limbs are snapped and her eyes turn to milk. She drops to the floor and swoons in the arms of Lucas. Then the bells chime and a rift cuts Jason in half. All of Hawkins becomes an open cruciform gate. Eleven brings Max back from the dead into some kind of comatose state. So we see Vecna's plan kind of unfold here, right? The big gate is now open. And initially, I think I was wondering, like, okay, but Max didn't really die. How did he get this gate open? But I guess we learn a little bit later on that...
She does.
She was dead for a whole minute.
Yeah.
I guess that was long enough for Vecna to do what he needed to do with the gate.
Yeah, he just had a technicality. Whatever it was he had going on, it required 4 deaths. And you know, even though, you know, Miracle Max is like mostly dead, it still worked.
Nice. Miracle Max. Excellent. Yeah, okay. So, all right. this kind of points us forward to season five, right? Because are we just going to see like a full on like Terminator sequel where the whole world has been kind of taken over and now we're in sort of this apocalyptic earthen upside down situation?
It's going to really, depend on do we pick up right where we left off, which is like we get that first little upside down, particles.
Uh-huh.
You know, is it in the beginning of happening, or is it an inevitability? I mean, it'd be something if we did a time jump and it's just this, you can't tell where the upside down ends and the regular world begins.
I think what they could do is a time jump at the end of episode one or something. You know, so they could like resolve Max's situation, bring her back somehow, and then 4 years later.
Yeah, so I can see that.
Here's my issue. All right, so there's something about what Vecna does here that allows the upside down to bleed atmospherically into, you know, all of Hawkins. And to me, this feels like, how is this not like a worldwide event?
Right. Mm-hmm. So the question becomes, is it... Because the vision that Nancy had, the monsters are loose in Hawkins.
Yeah,
and,
that's right.
And so,
yeah, that's, I forgot about Nancy's vision. You're right.
So the vision, you know, again, going to that sort of Terminator 2, because, you know, that was... Sarah Connor would have these visions of the apocalypse and
nice, that's right. I forgot.
And so she sees, and if you follow that was Terminator being a total time travel, film. I mean, that's if we're following that sort of format,
sure,
or potentially
sure.
Going forward, if that's the hints that we're getting, like maybe if this season was Nightmare on Elm Street, then is the next season Terminator. And what would you do in the Terminator? Well, they went back to try to stop something from happening, right? Like, mm-hmm. And then somebody else went back to protect the kid, right? So, I mean, there's who knows how that is going to work out. Like, could they flip the script and they have to go back and stop Vecna from ever happening? I don't know. I mean, those are interesting things that can happen.
Okay, so here's my concern with the whole global hellscape upside down situation. I feel like what has made this show unique and really really special and really fun is it's like kind of revisiting your childhood with all the pop culture references. Mm-hmm. And you care just as much about whether Mike and Elle are gonna make it work as you care about defeating the Demogorgon. If this whole thing turns into this global upside down hellscape, I think that you lose a lot of the like, hey, fun kid, kids having fun going to the mall, that part,
right? Yeah, because it's never as much fun in the upside down, except for this season we got a little bit, with some sweet heavy metal jams, and
sure,
we had some heart to hearts between Steve and Eddie even. And so those things definitely, is space for that, but the tension is, it's not like, yeah, to your point, it's like you can watch them at the mall, you can watch them at a dance, and the tension that's there is, it's puberty, it's just transitioning to adulthood, there's all these different types of tension, and that there's badness in some dimension, but it's not as imminent, right? Whereas if you're in the upside down, even in mid conversation, you're like, yeah, but a bat could come get your neck, right? Like, so it does take, and then it becomes a little less relatable, right? Now, we could have already built that relatable currency over the course of four seasons. At this point, the characters are pretty well established. The relationships,
let's say it starts with the hellscape, and then we do a little bit of Back to the Future stuff. So they get to go back to Hawkins as it was before, and then we get to revisit all of the pop culture stuff in that
way. Right, so there's definitely that possibility, right? Like, how do we, you know, if there's something, you know, time travel seems like it's going to be a part of this. And what they've already established is that they can do some pretty cool effects to make Elle look very young, younger than we've ever seen her.
Absolutely.
So there is, you know, unlike Back to the Future 2, where it's a bit of a trudge to see the old Michael J. Fox and, and young Michael J. Fox.
Sure. Yeah.
They could certainly have a lot more with this. And, you know, to your point, like, then that's how you can maybe restore that while, you know, kind of have a cake and eat it too. Like, there's still a hellscape to navigate, but there's, you know, some of them are, you know, some are in the hellscape. Some have now found a way to go back to Hawkins in 83 or something.
A couple of little segments from this storyline. At one point, Eleven says Papa was not a Papa was a monster, and then Vecna says he was not a monster. He was just a mediocre man who sought greatness in others. And I just wanted to say this kind of aligns with your interpretation of Modine in the Papa episode. You know, like, the way he dies is kind of mediocre, and that is sort of fitting for his... He didn't sort of deserve a grandiose exit. So this is exactly kind of what Vecna is saying about Papa.
Right, and I think I think that's in alignment with that. One thing I do want to say about this, and it'd be remiss if I didn't mention it, Heather had a... This storyline bothered Heather from a narrative standpoint because she felt like Elle had become too badass to be that easily thrown around, like, when it came down to, like, because here we, you know, we see her lifting Nina, you know, we see
helicopters
and then Vecna, you know, comes out the gate, she gets Vecna up, but then she's easily sort of, it's turned around. So I think she kind of felt like that. It seemed as, and it may have been a bit of a an issue of, this is a classic, you know, you've empowered a woman or, you know, female character, but only to a certain degree. And I think that might have been a little bit of her critique. I took it, you know, maybe because I'm just, you know, advocating for the show at this point and trying to find the logic where maybe it's not always there. It's one thing to lift Nina in a lab. You know, and even the helicopter, I mean, obviously she's got all this, you know, bullets coming towards her. But Vecna's a different adversary. I mean, Vecna's her equal, if not superior. So that's the thing, is that it's one thing to train it and one thing to practice it. It's one thing to be jumping around Dagobah. It's another thing to be face-to-face with Vader.
Well, to Heather's point, and I'm not sure how I feel about this, but to Heather's point, boy, they sure spent a lot of time this season building up her Jedi training.
Mm-hmm.
So, they just spent hours upon it. Hours upon hours of her...
She was absent for everybody else's
journey. Going through the
journey.
Nina Project. You brought back Modine for this very purpose, so that she could go through the Nina Project. And so for the end of it, for her to seem just... You know, she's just as powerful as before. I kind of feel that plot hole a bit.
Yeah, yeah.
Side of it, I might say that all along the rules of her magic has been she can be really powerful and it takes a lot out of her.
Yeah.
So I they kind of did the same thing. Like, she was really powerful. She could, like, levitate Vecna, throw Vecna around, and then she's drained a little bit.
Yeah, that I think can work. I think the other side, my other argument was, it's just Empire Strikes Back. Papa said, if we do take Papa at his word, even though it's hard to, her training was not complete, and she left Dagobah because her friends and
that's right. Yeah,
so while her. she's more powerful, she may not have. There may be an element that she's not quite mastered yet, and that could be the sustaining part, or it could be an extra, you know, turbo boost. I don't know.
Okay. I like that you're bringing in Star Wars, because there was an element where when Vecna says, look, I see your friends. I see them. And I got a little bit of the Emperor saying...
Oh, yeah, for sure.
Oh, I'm afraid the deflector shield will be quite operational when your friends...
By the time your friends are back.
So, I like that. Definitely got that. And then there were a number of religious themes that we've been calling out throughout this season. And... because of all of the other religious elements, I feel like probably should mention the ones that seem to be pretty overt in this episode. And I won't call them all out, but I will call out a few. So when Eleven is sort of like tied up and watching Max be murdered, basically, she's kind of like in a Christ pose, cruciform, right?
Right.
And then when Max is talking to her, he says, I believe you could move mountains.
Mm-hmm.
Right. So that's an allusion to something Jesus says in the Bible. And then, which is interesting to me because he also says, I believe you can fly. And then I thought, she can fly. are we going to see some actual Eleven flying like Neo in the Matrix in season 5?
Yeah. Well, maybe. I mean, yeah, that speech felt like it served multiple purposes, right? I mean, obviously the main one is to fuel her with love and acceptance.
Yeah, which happens in the Matrix, by the way.
Yeah, and then, but that also, it does feel like there might be some foreshadowing in there. Yeah. And Mike serves a purpose finally in this season.
Yeah, and then I'll just call out one more bit because this is the most overt when Eddie is dying. He says to Dustin, he says, you're going to have to take care of those little sheep.
Yeah.
Which is exactly what Jesus tells Peter when he's about to, you know, leave.
Yeah. And
anyway.
I would say that the parallels don't stop there. I mean, I would imagine, I don't think it's in scripture, but I imagine that Jesus could shred on the axe.
Yeah, this is sort of apocryphal material. This is the Gospel of Axel, yeah. which isn't dated to the 4th century, but we do have a few fragments from the 3rd century, so it could be old. But it was unfortunate because Jesus and Peter have creative differences, and they can't really
band together. It is. Really a beautiful set of, I mean, like, I know, like you said, the scriptures aren't like fully intact, but I do think that, I mean, when he refers to, because they don't say like tend to my sheep, he says, you know, tend to the sweet children of mine. And I think that that's really sweet. You know, and he says, you know, I go to prepare a place for you. It's Paradise City. I think that's a wonderful.
Yeah. Well. There's this massive interlude in the middle of it. Yeah. Some people think it's just lacuna because the worms have eaten the manuscript, but my theory is that it is a sort of a November rain esque interlude that just happens in the middle of this ancient manuscript. But anyway, I don't want to get into sort of my day job. This is supposed to be fun for me. I don't want to taint this podcast with my interests.
No, I think that's. But yeah, if anybody wants to do the research, it's definitely available for you.
Yeah, yeah. Do your own research.
Yeah, I mean, and you know what? It's gonna take a little while, but you know, just exercise patience.
All right, I'm gonna roll this thing.
Here are the highlights coming up this week on Bald Move.
House of the Dragon Season 2 is coming up sooner than you think. And to get us all back in that Leal state of mind, Aaron and I have teamed up with Maester Anthony to bring you coordinated coverage, new and old. For the next 10 weeks leading up to Season 2, Maester Anthony will be releasing an episode of his Season 1 coverage on the Hot D podcast. He originally recorded and released it exclusively on his Double Dragon podcast, so while it's retro coverage, it's almost certainly new to you.
In addition, each Friday, Jim and I will be reading the relevant sections of George Martin's Targaryen history book, Fire and Blood, so that we can compare and contrast it to that week's episode of Hot D Season 1. So grab a copy of Fire and Blood and read along with us if you're so inclined. Just don't read ahead, unless you enjoy spoilers.
If that's not enough to satisfy your craving for fantasy entertainment, well, you're in luck. We recently watched King Arthur, Legend of the Sword, which is Guy Ritchie's uniquely stylish and anachronistic riff on the King Arthur legend. Yes, Guy Ritchie took on the most famous of all English legends and did it with huge ambitions. Sadly, or perhaps thankfully, depending on your tastes, his ambitions were cut short by meager audience interest. Join us for the podcast this Tuesday as we discuss why that might have been and whether this retelling is any good.
You can find these and many other great podcasts by searching for Bald Move Pulp or Bald Move Prestige in your favorite podcast app.
We're getting geared up for the 6th annual Summer Badass Fest. And while we're working on a slate of apex badass films to enjoy, we've got an early action-packed announcement to make.
Just like last year, we're kicking off Badass Season with a live movie watch and podcast recording. We've rented out a theater for connoisseurs of action films and Bald Move fans that just want to have a great time.
Unlike last year, this year's movie is top secret. Hush, hush. No hints, except it's incredibly badass. It stars an absolute icon of the genre. We're willing to bet most of you haven't seen it, and it's going to be an incredible viewing experience with a packed house of Bald Movers.
Those of you who came to last year's screening of Total Recall know what a party it was. And those of you who didn't, now's your chance to experience it. Meet me and Jim, order some custom movie-themed drinks at the theater's full bar, then watch us record the full podcast for the movie. We reserved a venue over twice the size as last year, but seating is still limited.
It's happening Friday, June 21st at 7 p.m. in our hometown of Cincinnati. Get full details and buy tickets at baldmove.com/live.
Cincinnati's actually a pretty great city to visit, and we've got lots of details for side adventures on our event page as well. The Reds are playing the Boston Red Sox in their fantastic Riverside Stadium. The thrills of Kings Island just minutes away, and I'll be leading a kayak trip down the scenic Little Miami River on Saturday.
Again, get full details and get your tickets now on our Badass Fest 6 page at baldmove.com/live.
Fell off the table. I don't know if that counts. Should I roll it again? What is your feeling about dice that roll off the table?
Unless explicitly said otherwise before the game is played, I say play it as it lies.
Oh, okay. Well, I grabbed it. I should have let it fall on the floor. So I'm just going to roll it again here.
Yeah, now it's a double tap.
All right. This is the Sinclair Kids versus the Basketball Dummies. Erica has been overpowered by the basketball goon, by basketball goon number two. Jason discovers Lucas and Max in the attic. Jason holds a gun and demands that Max be woken up. Lucas refuses and tries to explain the upside down signs to Jason. Jason shoots and misses. Lucas ducks the bullet, and the two fight. Lucas gets strangled as Max levitates. Then he fights back, and Jason gets his ass beat. Lucas tries to keep Max from checking out and tells Erica to get an ambulance. A lot of Stand By Me. I was feeling the Stand By Me vibes.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I mean, there's that amazing... This is some really cool stuff there when he says, you know, he basically goes into the Will Wheaton character, right? I mean,
yeah, everyone's gonna die. Nope, not everyone.
Yeah, just you,
Jason. If I wake her too soon, we all die. Now, you don't wake her up right now, you die, Sinclair. Just you.
What was Kiefer Sutherland's character?
Ace,
that's right.
Just you, Ace.
So I definitely felt that, and I think we talked quite a bit about that over at Cocoons of Horror when we covered that episode. So I did want to say something about a key moment in this scene. So they're fighting, and Jason steps on the Walkman, right?
Mm-hmm.
And he breaks the cover off the Walkman, and he breaks the headphones, right? I just want to say, as someone who used this bit of technology for years, that will not keep that device from working.
Right.
I mean, you could break off the cover. You could just put, like, broken headphones to your ears. Half of the headphones I used when I was a kid were scotch taped.
Wild that, like, I can't seem to get an iPhone cord to stay operational for, like, 2 months before it just starts to disconnect. But, yeah, we could, like, there were times where I'm like, oh, my gosh, I've been listening to this thing for, like, 4 hours, and there's no batteries in it. That's weird.
Upside down magic.
That's right.
Yeah, you could, I mean, seriously, it's really hard to break these things. All you have to do is, like, hold the headphone up to one of Max's ears, and you get her right out of the state with Kate Bush.
Right.
So, I mean, of course, you know, Lucas is being strangled at the time. All right. Anything else about this? I think we've covered this particular storyline pretty thoroughly in the last episode. So.
Yeah, I mean, it's a interesting way that he goes, right? I mean, like, talk about Papa's death, and he felt like a little bit unceremonious. I mean, mm-hmm. Jason gets killed by the very thing that he should have been really afraid of the whole time, right?
It's true, but he also gets Darth Mauled.
Yeah, it's true. We don't know if we're gonna get robot Jason later.
All right, I'm gonna roll this thing. Damn, I lost it again. I caught it. I didn't let it go on the ground. Even after you told me. Number two. Scooby-Doo gang versus Vecna. After hopscotching over Vecna vines, a gang is ensnared. The tentacles come to life and tie them to the hallway walls. They all drop their weapons and are choked. They are choked for like an hour and a half. And then they find Vecna in a trance. They firebomb him. Fire seems to mildly annoy him, but Nancy's shotgun blows him out of the attic window. Outside, on the ground, it seems that Vecna has escaped. You mentioned before, Steve, that you thought maybe this is all part of Vecna's plan.
Right.
At one point he says, you think that you've won, but you know the world's going to end. This is just the beginning. And I was going to say that the way that this all kind of goes down in the attic is I don't think Vecna's planned for any of this. Or maybe it just doesn't really matter.
Right. Like, it could be one of those things where he knows either way. It's like, you guys can't, because he's gone, right? I mean, he's clearly not dead. He disappears in the mind state.
Mm-hmm.
In the physical state, because he's getting jacked up in the physical state, but then he. So I want a part of me almost wonders, did they do the right thing? Because like we looked at everybody helping.
Mm-hmm.
Did they? Right. I mean, that's a question that I still have. Is that, you know, Elle's kind of taken care of, but then he disappears because she was kind of taking care of him in the mind state, because in the physical state he's getting. Jacked up, but mm-hmm. but in a way, like, did they end up kind of setting him free? Because if they had just left him there with Eleven, would she have been able to psychically destroy him? But because like he sort of unplugs because of getting firebombed, he's able to physically get away.
Well, they've got no idea that Eleven's helping out. Right.
Right. I know. I'm just saying, is that what, you know, is that a possibility that, because from us as the viewer, sure. We're like, oh my gosh, look at all these, like, we have Upside Down Hawkins. We've got, Elle in a pizza shop. And then we've got Russia, and like, they're all coming together without even realizing it. But I almost wonder if that made it worse.
I don't know. And it's, I think one of the weaknesses of this show is that it's hard to know what is actually going to do harm to the monsters.
Right.
You know, sometimes you can just burn them. You can just burn them alive. You know, sometimes a shotgun will totally, you know, cause you to kind of step back. And sometimes a shotgun will, like, blow you right out the attic window or whatever. So I'm not really sure what does what to what monster in this show.
Right. Well, and we just met Vecna. We didn't, you know, this is the first, you know, we didn't know any of his weaknesses until towards the end anyway.
Sure.
Even still, we're like, all right, well, we don't know.
Okay. One thing about this, because we were talking about the connectivity of all these storylines, there's a lot of sort of splicing together of like everything's kind of happening at one time, kind of thing, right? Well, right after Robin gets dropped from the Vecna vines, she says, "I don't believe in a higher power, but that was a miracle."
Mm.
And I thought, okay, let's make sure we do the callback here, because at one point Hopper did say, "I'm here to do something to help Eleven and Hawkins," or something like that.
Right.
And Jack and Hagar basically says, "Oh, you're starting to sound religious."
Right.
And then Hopper starts talking about, you know, expecting a miracle. So that's, you know, all of a sudden we see this miracle language being used in Hawkins, and it's basically because Hopper turns into a miraculous hero in Russia. So I think that they're trying to play with that a bit.
Be your own miracle.
Be your own miracle. Harrington flips a flashlight at one point. My son was like, "That's totally cringy."
Really?
And I said, no, that's a callback. Remember, he used to do a little bat flip. Way back in season one, when he was fighting that Demogorgon, he would hit it with a bat and he would flip it again. You know, and I think that immediately he's, you know, we've got the old Harrington back. He's going to go fight the monster.
So you know, I know cringy is kind of a thing. You know, I mean, mm-hmm. not that cringiness has just happened. You know, it's not a recent phenomenon. It's just that but pointing it out is certainly, I think, a little bit more of a recent phenomenon.
Sure.
What's cringy? Just because he flipped it?
I think he was like, thinking why something like...
Why was that cringy?
He's at camp. I'm going to have to ask him when he gets back. But my sense was that, look, if you're in this haunted house in the Upside Down, and you got this monster guy in the next room, are you going to feel confident, so confident, that you're willing to just flip this flashlight into the air? Or are you going to be a little bit more careful with your devices?
See, I get the sense of cringy, like something like, "Oh, that's them trying to be like the director trying to make him cool, and that's not cool. People don't flip flashlights."
Well, yeah, right. The only reason to flip it is to make that character look cool.
Mm-hmm.
But I was.
I'm concerned that cringy is getting overused. I just mm-hmm. think that like there's things that could be cheesy. Yeah. And I'm not
saying that my son is cool. I mean, that's the last thing that I would ever say.
So. Well, yeah, I mean, I just don't want us to dilute cringe. I think there are certainly cringeworthy things, and mm-hmm. there are things that are cringy. But I mean, if we just start labeling anything that's awkward or uncomfortable as cringy, mm-hmm. I think we dilute the language. And I want cringe to still mean something.
You're just taking a stand. This is brave. This is quite brave of you, Steve.
I want to be on the right side of history with cringe.
I do want to say the Scooby-Doo gang versus Vecna, this was a very minor part of this episode.
Right. It was, right?
And it was a long episode. And this, you know, the whole Steve, Nancy, Robin part of this was really quite minor compared to all the other stuff.
Yeah, and it felt, I don't know if I felt like the payoff wasn't worth it. It was just interesting that all this effort goes into it. You know, you kill Eddie so that they can do this thing.
Yeah.
And they didn't, I mean, then they, yeah. and then they just kind of go do it. No, it's, so that part.
This is supposed to be phase four. They had a four phase plan.
Yeah.
And phase four was kind of like, I guess they were trying to show that, you know, Hopper really helped and the Eleven's really helping. I all of that overshadowed the Scooby-Doo gang part of this.
Which is a big deal, right? Because, I mean, this is the Scooby-Doo gang going face-to-face with the physical Vecna. And this should have a pretty big moment. I mean, I guess there's a big moment in the sense that, like, Nancy's just gone full Sigourney, I mean, at this point, right? I mean...
Sure, yeah.
Which is I think, a fun, you know, it's a fun thing for the character. And I think it bodes well, in my opinion, for the next... season. I mean, Nancy's always been sort of ramping up, but I feel like now Nancy's just in a whole new space.
A lot of this, yeah, no, a lot of this episode is about Eddie's ultimate bravery, right? So he's a coward, and he finds his bravery. You know, he proves himself to be heroic, right? I think lost in the shuffle there is that whenever there's shit that needs to get done, Nancy's like the first person in, right? She's like the first person to jump in. She's going to crawl into the Upside Down. She's going to dive into the Watergate. She's going to, you know, she's going to get the sawed-off shotgun. She is full Sigourney at this point, right?
Yeah, and, you know, and she's even got the vision, right? I mean, interesting that, like, Vecna chooses her to deliver the message, right? And so she's in a unique spot now, right? I mean, like, I know not imprinted maybe in the same way that Will is, because I think Will still has something inside him to some degree. So the idea that there's monsters, the idea that, like, her family in particular are in danger, because they stay, right? And that's what I think is interesting too about the Wheelers is they're sticking around. You know, while everybody else is bouncing.
I want to talk about that. I'm wondering, like, what are they thinking? What is Ted thinking? He's not gonna leave his television. Like, that's like, the whole town is crumbling. You've got a massive rift that has killed 14 people in this town.
You have the Upside Down
bleeding in.
A year after there was this mall fire that killed like 42 people.
Yeah. Ted's like, I think I see what's on the news.
I mean, if I see a, like, two spiders in the same day, I consider putting my house up for sale.
All right, I'm going to roll this thing. All right, this is a six. This is the Hawkins reunion. Oh, good. We get to talk about what we were just talking about. 2 days after Hawkins has been ripped into four quadrants, Argyle's van rolls into town. The boys see the devastation. A local newsman reports that Eddie Munson is presumed dead. The gang and the boys reunite. Lucas reads a Stephen King novel to comatose Max. Then Eleven and the boys arrive. Eleven tries to find Max on the astral plane to no avail. Then Robin and friends volunteer at the disaster relief center. Robin flirts with Molly Ringwald, and Dustin shares a moment with Eddie's uncle. The gang tries to clean up Hopper's cabin, and Jonathan and Nancy pretend everything is okay. Will says he can feel Vecna, who is still alive. Then Hopper returns and hugs Eleven. They admire their haircuts, and everyone hugs everyone. The sky darkens, and the upside-down particles fall on the town of Hawkins. Okay, at one point, Henry says to Eleven that the massacre, the children who are died in the Hawkins massacre, that they're not really dead, they're in his head, right? He points to his skull and says, they're in here.
Right.
So is this how you get Max back?
Well, did you do any research? Or
I did zero research.
On the talisman?
I didn't do any, no.
So I did very little. I mean, I'll be honest. I was supposed to do more, but but what I do know about the talisman is, it's
just it's for reference. The talisman is the book that Lucas is reading
to Max. So the main character is trying to save his mother, who is dying of cancer, and he wants to get a talisman to get this talisman, he has to go through a parallel universe.
Interesting.
So there's like twinners or the parallel individuals of the people in our world. And like one can die in one world, but not the other necessarily.
Interesting.
I think it has to be where we're going to some degree, right? I mean,
Max is like bifurcated, like part of her, and it could be like the primary part of her psyche is somewhere on this other plane, right?
Right, because the thing that's interesting, so the difference about, you know, this world in the talisman versus what we've seen with the upside down is we don't, you know, they encounter their world, but they don't encounter themselves, right? Like they don't see people. They see the houses, they see, and the artifacts are there, right? They're all, they may be gooey or whatever, but like the idea was, hey, we can go get our guns. Oh, no, we can't because it's 1983, but you can still see my diary. You can see all those things. Those are all preserved, but there's no people. So that's what I find, you know, so that's an interesting thing about the difference between the novel that he's reading and what we've seen. So then, but then it makes you wonder, it's like, well, were there people that either Vecna or the Mind Flayer have like captive or they killed? Can you go back to a certain time and find, you know, that version of yourself maybe before that happened? So this is where it can get really interesting and really explore a lot of space. Now, what I've understood is that they're not going to make this upcoming season as long as this one, at least in terms of just runtime. So
I think it's impossible.
Now that
Hopper's back in the U.S.,
you just shaved down off like three episodes.
Yeah, exactly.
But if you're going to do something as complex as potentially time travel or parallel universe, I feel like you do need to spend a little time. You know, it has the potential to get real, real confusing. Mm-hmm. Unless he's just reading the talisman because it's a Stephen King book and it happens to involve like a parallel world and this one has that. I don't believe you would have that here being read to somebody who's, again, when the whole point of that story is he's trying to get this talisman to save his dying mother.
I think it's probably worth calling out that the way that the Duffer brothers choose to bring in references, they choose to bring in a reference that doesn't necessarily script the story going forward, right? So just because there might be something like this in season 5 doesn't mean that this is going to be prescriptive in any way of how the show will end. Right. Just because they bring in Molly Ringwald, and it's very clear that it's Molly Ringwald, right?
Right, right.
This is a Molly Ringwald homage, does not necessarily say that the Breakfast Club is going to be predictive of how Stranger Things is going to end any more than, you know, bringing in, you know, Jesus references is going to tell us that it's going to end that way or
Empire Strikes Back.
Exactly, exactly.
Though this does have a little bit of that Empire Strikes Back, though, doesn't it? Like at the end when Empire Strikes Back, when they're all looking off into the, you know, into the universe, it's like, hey, someone's got to go find, you know, Han. And you know, it's a cliffhanger, right? This is the one. I mean, all of them, like we've talked about, this is the first one that had a clear cliffhanger ending, right? Like it wasn't a post-credit scene that invited you. And this was Empire Strikes Back. Like, just built that way, right? I mean,
yeah. There's this moment when Dustin is talking with Eddie's uncle, where he goes full Frodo Baggins.
Right. Yeah.
I could not see Frodo. He's got the curly hair. He's sitting there. He's got the super curly hair. His ears are kind of poking out, and I'm just thinking, oh my gosh, this guy is Frodo Freaking Frodo Baggins. You could get that sense like he's kind of returned to the Shire, and he's, you know, he this is kind of the scouring of the Shire moment.
Well, and they had, you know, they've already made a Lord of the Rings reference to him and Eddie got, right?
Exactly. So
the Shire is burning.
Yeah, exactly.
Also, there are werewolves in the Talisman, and I know you're a big werewolf fan, so ooh, I just thought
now I'm going to go read it. Time to go read the Talisman.
So fingers crossed that Eddie is actually a werewolf.
Ooh, that'd be fantastic. All right, so we finally get the Hopper L reunion, right?
Right.
You kind of get the sense that she's saying, I didn't really ever believe that you were really dead. She doesn't say it that way, but she said, I kept the door open.
Right.
I kept the door open 3 inches or whatever it was. How did you feel about this reunion?
I think it was really effective. I kind of like that there's still like a parallel between the fact that she doesn't seem to ever get these gates fully closed either. So doors you being open are always kind of a thing. Kind of her thing.
She never really ever closes the fridge door. This is always a problem. The lid's back on the peanut butter when she's done.
I leave a crack open for a demi-dog.
Mm-hmm. I almost felt more emotion when she's hugging Joyce.
Yeah. Yeah, I kind of felt that too, which I thought was, you know, something that we didn't see a bunch of. But there was that. Because, I mean, just because of the need for the mother and she knows her mother, right?
Yeah. This is Dustin and Eddie part two. And after the Master of Puppets solo concert, Dustin and Eddie lock themselves inside Eddie's upside down mobile home. The bats eventually find unsealed vents and bust through. Dustin climbs up the sheets to the other side, but Eddie decides to stay back to buy more time. He bikes off and the bats chase him. Dustin comes back to help Eddie, but Eddie is surrounded by hundreds of bats. Eddie is chomped by bats until Vecna has been weakened by the Russia contingent and 11. Then the bats all die for some reason. Eddie dies in Justin's arms, but before departing for that big mosh pit in the sky, he makes Dustin promise to take care of his sheep. I kind of joked about this earlier, but this is a full-on Axl Rose homage, right? With the bandana and the long hair.
Oh, yeah, for sure.
Yeah, I couldn't not see Axl Rose here. And then, of course, the hair's a little bit Slash, right?
Yeah, he's like the best of all worlds. He's both guns and roses.
All right, so my son was thrilled with this scene with Eddie fighting the bats. There's this one scene where he's like, come on! And like the thunder just cracks. You know, the lightning flashes behind him. He was like, that was a W scene for sure.
Nice.
He enjoyed that. And then, of course, Eddie dies. And I think that this is probably as emotional as any character in the show, which is kind of saying something.
Right. I mean, this is they did a great job. And again, I mean, I know you got converted throughout the season.
Totally. I'm a full on, you know, full member of the cult of Eddie.
Yeah. And watching and see, I was an early adopter. So this was even harder to watch. I mean, both Heather and I very choked up. Well, even the second time around. You know, thinking back to how he gets introduced, he's just, you know, it's a really clever thing that they did. They Harringtoned him in a season and some things, you know, even when some things like felt a little on the nose, it was still sold. It still worked. I mean, the actor just sold it and it was just, and then to have this moment with Dustin too, because, you know, Dustin's such an interesting character that they've brought along, and how he keeps getting put in different spots, right? I mean, he teams up with Steve, and now he's teamed up with Eddie, and it's when people break off. I mean, Dustin makes these connections and serves a rich purpose for the show, not only to kind of move the plot along in a way to naturally get the exposition out there so it doesn't feel like you're just being told how to follow along.
Okay, I just want to say this about Dustin. There's something about not caring about popularity that makes you kind of like intriguing to older kids.
Sure.
There's something about, oh, that kid doesn't care what I think. You know, even despite the age difference, I'm kind of intrigued by this younger. It's really hard to know that when you're in junior high. Because you think, okay, if I just say, what does that person want me to say? What would be the cool thing to say right now?
Mm-hmm.
And you're really obvious. And older kids don't want to be around that, right? Dustin is the kind of kid, because he doesn't care about popularity at all, he's kind of intriguing to these older characters. So he can kind of make friends more easily with someone like Steve, with someone like Eddie, and it's believable. And I think the rest of these kids, they all care about popularity, at least at on some level, right?
Right.
Dustin, for some reason, he's immune to that in the way that hobbits are kind of immune to the ring of power.
Mm, interesting.
Anyway, I like that part of Dustin, and so I like them pairing him up with Eddie in this season.
Yeah, and you're right. It does make a lot of sense that he would be more accepted by the older kid. And what happens, too, by also because there's still the recognition that he is a kid, there's a sense of protection, right? I mean, Harrington mm-hmm. and Eddie, you know, they look out for him, right? And they look right. out for him not just because he's a kid, but also because they appreciate him. And they know what he serves for them, right? I mean, they get from him as much as they give to him.
Hey, it's time for another season of Why is Mr. Feeny a Car? The premise is simple. A Gen Xer and a millennial watch old 80s action TV to see what still works and what doesn't. In previous seasons, we've done podcasts for Knight Rider, Airwolf, MacGyver, A-Team, and more. However, this year we're doing a very special season of Feeny. We're going back and reviewing the very special episodes of 80s and 90s sitcoms. Come cringe along with us as Hollywood tries to warn our families of the dangers of underage smoking, drug abuse, alcoholism, eating disorders, and much more. We start out with the episode of Boy Meets World where a high school kid gets sucked into a cult. Worlds collide as the Mr. Feeny finally makes an appearance on Why is Mr. Feeny a Car? Join me and my buddy Jay each week for episodes full of nostalgia and secondhand embarrassment. And don't worry, a very special isn't your speed. We've also got some all-time classic Knight Rider episodes to close the season with. Find Why is Mr. Feeny a Car? Each Wednesday on Bald Move Pulp, starting April 3rd.
FX is adapting James Clavell's best-selling novel, Shogun, into a 10-part miniseries this spring. Set in the shogunate period of Japan at the turn of the 15th century, Shogun depicts the rise of a feudal lord to Shogun, as seen through the eyes of a shipwrecked English sailor. It's loosely based on the real-life exploits of William Adams and Tokugawa Ieyasu.
Shogun has already been successfully adapted back in 1980 with a widely acclaimed miniseries starring Richard Chamberlain. Featuring intricate plots, political scheming, complex characters, and thrilling action. This time, husband and wife team Justin Marks and Rachel Kondo try to recapture the successes of the novel and early adaptations, while increasing the levels of historical and cultural accuracy that are often perceived as flaws of this and similar works.
Starring Hiroyuki Sanada from The Last Samurai, Mortal Kombat, and John Wick 4, with Cosmo Jarvis of Peaky Blinders, Raised by Wolves, etc., joining the truly massive cast required to bring this complex world to life. Join Aaron and I each week as we deep dive into each episode, uncovering the mysteries, the intrigue, and the glory of Shogun.
Shogun premieres on FX Hulu Tuesday, February 27th, with a two-part debut. Our podcast will release each Thursday thereafter. Get our Shogun coverage by searching for Bald Move Prestige in your favorite podcast app. We're about 10 weeks out from House of the Dragon Season 2, and it's time to prepare for war.
Which in our case means, well, watching a lot of Hot D and reading a lot of Fire and Blood.
Each week between now and June 16th, Maester Anthony and his co-host Steve are hosting a watch of each episode of Hot D Season 1. And then me and Jim are going to host a discussion of the differences between the events on that episode and how they're recounted in George R.R. Martin's historical tome, Fire and Blood.
That's right, I've resorted to reading dragon books. God help us all. We'll see if my fresh eyes add any new insights or predictions into Season 2.
Arm yourselves with all the lore you can for the battles ahead. House of the Dragon returns June 16th, but we've got you covered until then.
Check out all of our upcoming Hot D coverage on the Hot D feed or on Bald Move Pulp, available wherever you listen to podcasts.
All right, final storyline. This is number one, the Russia plot, part two. Hopper devises a plan to kill the creatures. He's going to bait them into the arena. Murray will blowtorch them, and Joyce will lock them in. Hopper whistles at a demodog and runs for the arena. One of the dogs takes Hopper down, but Joyce uses a cattle prod to save him. They make it to the arena, where Murray rains down fire from heaven. This, it seems, Vecna and his army of monsters. The dogs are burnt, but the Demogorgon remains. Hopper gets the Conan sword that happens to be lying around and cuts down the creature in slow motion. Then the Russians show up with Kantinka as Murray hoots. At some point, my son was watching this thing. My son was watching this thing with me, and he said, "Not these poopies. Nobody cares about you guys."
Yeah, I mean, this is the big payoff, right? And this is what we were waiting for.
And I don't think he's talking about the demodogs. I think talking about Hopper.
He's talking about...
It was just funny. Huh? You know, he's 15 years old. To hear a 15-year-old, you know, guy who's really concerned with being cool called... call these beloved characters poopies.
Yeah.
It's pretty great.
I think it's the commentary on this generation's view of older people in general.
Right. Yeah. It could have
been. He's like, you can call, he's like, you know what? You can call yourself a boomer. You can call yourself a Gen X. You're all poopies.
So, did you see, I guess someone sent me this image of an old Conan movie where he's got the same sword, and I guess there was some confirmation that it was actually the same prop.
Oh, wow.
That was used.
So the Conan sword is just in Russia too.
Yeah,
Russia's all about their peanut butter and movie props.
If you remember back to what was going on, they were having each of these Russian prisoners choose a weapon to fight this.
And was the sword among them?
Yeah, I think that the idea was, we're going to give them weapons that will menace the creature but won't kill the creature. Because this was Hopper's view. It's like, look, this is a predator. It doesn't want dead meat. It wants to fight for its food. And so we're just going to give these weapons to you so that you can fight it, but ultimately you are food, right?
Right.
Do I have that? Did was that your that understanding of this?
Yeah, that was my take.
Okay, so then why can this sword slice through a Demogorgon?
Right, yeah. If the sword was available, then it sort of, you know, was it hiding in the back? And they're like, oh, if they pick the right one, I would give them a fighting chance. We got a sword. I mean, I don't know. It's a pretty elaborate sword, because it's not supposed to be a movie prop.
It's super fancy.
Because it cuts off the head, so it's clearly supposed to be a sword. And it is
a
fancy sword.
This was my same critique of the first season of this. Is like, so bullets don't menace these things, but a baseball bat will.
Right, with nails in it.
And I'm just thinking, what is a bullet if not just a tiny little bit of metal that's coming at you really fast?
Yeah, it's not like they're indestructible. There are things that you can do with them.
So one idea I had was, okay, maybe the fire part of it burned off its hard exterior or something. I don't know if I'm thinking about this too hard, but it is a little odd to me that Hopper slices through this thing.
Yeah. I mean, and it's also, it's the Conan sword is a little of a odd choice because everything else was so American up until that point.
Uh-huh.
You know, we got Hulk Hogan, we got red, white, and blue puffy jackets, we got, you know. So, I mean, it just seemed like, is there not an American prop you can use? Is there, you know, can you, like, beat him to death with, like, a Patrick Swayze statue or something?
The Footloose dancing shoes.
Yeah. See, just anything. Maybe the welding torch from Flashdance would suffice. You still use fire.
I just figured it out. You can't kill this creature unless you kill it in slow-mo.
Oh, right. Or
so because it took like 14 minutes for Hopper to slide across the ground and kill this thing.
Right.
It's like a video game if you like build up energy.
Got it. Well, I like the idea that...
a special move, right?
I know this isn't how it played out, but it kind of felt like that, where you're like, oh, here's a scene where, you know, this is happening. Here's a scene where this is happening. Oh, my gosh, they're moving from here to there. Okay, Ella's transferring there. It's like, and then we go to Hopper's slow motion cut already in progress. And I'm just like, it travels the course of like an hour of him just raising and then dropping it down.
Can I just say, honestly... given how long this episode was, there was like 20 minutes of choking happening. And at one point, my son was like, these guys have been being choked for an hour. This is like a really slow choke happening.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, yeah, they go full David Carradine.
Yes, to complete the Tarantino callbacks.
Oh, man. It would,
those are just, they were just planting little seeds so that we would recognize the David Carradine actual death.
This is the story they've been trying to tell.
Show.